Hello, my name is Chip Lang. You're listening to Total EM. Today we have a very special first-time guest by the name of Michelle Perkins. She is a rural emergency medicine physician practicing in Maine, and she is going to talk to us about congestive heart failure, specifically about decompensated. She's got a lot to talk to us about today, but first, I want her to actually introduce herself. So Michelle, can you give us a little brief introduction about yourself?
Sure, Chip, and thanks for having me on. This is really exciting. As Chip said, I'm a rural emergency doc in down east Maine, critical access hospitals mostly. And recently I completed, last year, the Resuscitation Leadership Academy with Scott Weingart and Haley Malmet. So I have to put in a plug for this because it was just tremendously valuable, because there's so many times that we're hanging on to sick folks in the ED when you're working rurally because of transportation issues or lack of ICU beds. So it was just a really fantastic adjunct to any previous training that I had.
Yeah, and actually, I'm really impressed by RLA. I haven't got to do it yet. I'm so excited. I'm really wanting to do it sometime soon. But I think this goes to show you're pretty smart. And from what I've read about Maine, I haven't gone up that way yet. But Maine seems like a pretty remote place. So are you pretty far away from any sort of tertiary centers or from basically your closest backup?
Yeah, in both places that I work down east, it's about an hour flight from one of them to our tertiary center. And then I think it's a little bit longer than that, but on the ground, it's, you know, obviously a couple hours to get there. There's many times, of course, 'cause of the weather, that no chopper flying. So it makes some shifts very interesting sometimes, to be sure.
Oh, I bet. So the thing you want to talk to us about today is something I admit I don't know best how to manage sometimes, and it sounds like you've got a lot of learning you've done yourself on figuring this out, and it sounds like some of it through RLA, some of it just through your own research, but basically we're talking about CHF, like we said, decompensated, but I guess it'd be a good idea before we go too far in that to just talk about like a brief recap of what chronic CHF is like.
Well, sure. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this because we're all pretty familiar with the pathophysiology of this. But generally, when you're looking at it from an outpatient standpoint, it's divided into diastolic or systolic dysfunction, basically a pump issue or a relaxation issue. And that's helpful in the outpatient setting as far as the management goes. But generally, by the time they get to us, the distinction is kind of irrelevant because both systolic and diastolic dysfunction are in play at that point.
Yeah. And that's something that I think a lot of us forget about is really when you're that sick that you're actually being seen in the ED for your CHF, it's probably not just one or the other. It's probably a combined portion, which made me laugh. There was a recent SMAC. Yeah, SMAC that I was listening to recently where they talked about this one hospital with subspecialties in left heart failure and right heart failure and everything else. And I kind of laughed because I'm like, I'm just happy if I have a cardiologist on the phone most days, let alone someone who subspecializes in one or the other. But realistically, in most of our CHF patients, you're going to need both because there's a lot more that's going on to the picture.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So how do we define acute decompensated CHF?
Well, you have to look at, you know, the different things that could be causing this. You look at ischemia, you look at infection, you could look at arrhythmia. I mean, basically, the hallmark of decompensation is pulmonary edema. And this is more of a backup issue. You know, the left ventricle just for whatever reason can't handle the pulmonary venous return. So one or more of three things are generally happen at this point. You've got increased preload and or increased afterload and or decreased left ventricular function. And one thing, I'm going to get on my soapbox here, a really critical point to make is that traditional teaching is that these folks are fluid overloaded and therefore the treatment is focused on that aspect. And this is patently false. Most of these folks are actually fluid overloaded in their lungs. But as far as their total body goes, they're euvolemic or even hypovolemic. So unless you're actually standing there physically watching them get fluid overloaded, for example, like you're bolusing them 30 cc's per kilogram to meet a metric, assume that they aren't. These folks are generally run a bit dry as an outpatient. This is more of an issue of fluid redistribution, not necessarily total volume. But this distinction is really key for understanding how you correctly manage these people.
You act like that somehow there's some sort of metric out there that just encourages giving people lots and lots of fluids, and especially not in the patients who, you know, already weigh 400 pounds. You have to do it by total body weight because that's what the CMS, some sort of measure says about some sort of health condition that's highly popular in the news right now. That would never happen.
Never. You know, I've never actually done it myself, or I've never seen it done. But yeah, I mean, we're just talking hypothetically at this point, of course.
So that's my problem with this, is that these are patients that, this is why the underlying condition is so important. And a lot of people forget about, well, they come in for, I guess we should say it, huh, Michelle, sepsis. And, oh, they have CHF as well, and they're brittle with their CHF, and they have lots of problems with it. Well, I mean, the measure says we need to give them this fluid bolus. Oh, by the way, the measure also says that if you need to facilitate the fluid bolus, to go ahead and intubate them, which that's its own nature of the beast, but that's something that I don't feel really comfortable with. But let's say you went down this pathway or something, now you got to reverse that whole cause. Like you said, if you physically fluid overloaded them, that's one thing, but what you're talking about is very different.
Right, exactly, exactly. I mean, again, these people are typically, because they're being, you know, well-managed by their outpatient doc, they're typically running a little bit on the dry side for the most part, you know, assuming they've been compliant with their meds and everything like that that's been going on.
When we were talking back and forth, you had mentioned that Almatu has this great diagram. Can you kind of explain it a little bit?
Yeah, he has some great lectures out there on CHF, and basically he uses a bucket diagram. The total body is a large bucket, and then the lungs represented as a small bucket inside the large bucket. So when you're looking at that, okay, the small bucket is full up, but the body bucket isn't, and that actually is a good way to kind of just, in my simple mind, figure out the looking at the redistribution.
No, I love the analogy of that, and it's so simple because you think about, you can have the little bucket full and the larger bucket not always full, depending on how much is, you know, it's crossed over, whatever. It makes sense to me. I like it. I think it's a great point.
Yeah, it's great diagram.
Okay, so now let's talk about how these people present, because they obviously look different than your classic CHF patient.
Right. I mean, they come in and they just look sick. They'll say things like, I feel like I'm drowning, and they'll have this sense of impending doom, which should give one to you as well. They are dyspneic, they're hypoxic, and usually, in most cases, they're very hypertensive. There is a subset of the hypotensive patients, fortunately small, but they're pretty scary to manage, but we'll talk about them later. These guys are coughing up froth. You go to examine them, they've got crackles up to their ears. You put the ultrasound on and it just lights up with B-lines. And oh, by the way, on your site, that picture of the B-lines from your POCUS.
The dyspnea one.
Yes. Yeah, that was a great shot of B-lines. So if you want to know what I'm talking about, that would be a good representation.
We may just have to throw that picture back in there then.
I think so. So in any case, they look really sick and they need intervention like yesterday.
And speaking of the hypertension part, there's been a lot of discussion. In fact, the last post we just posted was about hypertension. And the way I like to put it, there's all different names. Scott Weingart calls it emergencies with a side of hypertension. I like the phrasing of clinically important hypertension in the emergency department, meaning that in this setting, we actually worry about it. We actually need to treat. This is one type of patient that we are needing to actually address this with, because in these patients, basically this hypertension is part of a bigger issue, but it's a red flag of something that needs to be treated underneath. And so I guess in a sense, that's one of the things we need to keep in mind. Scott Weingart, his first ever podcast was on SCAPE, which basically is related to everything that we're talking about here. And so now I guess, Michelle, before we get too far into how to treat it, what's the workup?
Well, I mean, typically, you know, it you do the obvious stuff. I mean, you send the labs, you do an EKG, but the bottom line is, you know, this is a clinical diagnosis, and your management needs to really begin in the first 5 minutes that they show up in the ED. So workup is done, but it's kind of secondary to all of the things that you're doing.
What about that BNP that the hospitalist wants so badly? Do I need to do it right away? Do I need that answer before everything else?
No, I mean, in my opinion, it's an absolutely useless test in an acute setting. I mean, maybe if you're dealing with the not sick, undifferentiated dyspneic patient that you're going to have to try to sell the hospitalist a diagnosis, you could send it off. But that's not who we're dealing with here. I mean, these people, you really, early management is key, and a BNP is not going to persuade you one way or the other to treat this patient appropriately.
And I totally agree with that. And it's pretty rare to have someone who has a low BNP who's obviously sick with CHF. It can happen, though. So don't discount the BNP for that. And you're not the only one who's out there saying that BNP is probably a worthless test for this acute type setting. There have been other smart people who've said the same thing, and we'll try and include some of that in the show notes too about other people who say that BNP is probably not good for the acute setting. Now, it's still worth getting, especially if your hospitals want it. They sometimes use it for trending purposes and whatnot, but for the ED, for right then, this is the perfect patient that throwing the bedside ultrasound on them and doing that quick dyspnea workup, if it's undifferentiated, is going to be a key part. But like you said, a lot of these people, it's really obvious that this is what they're coming in for. But sometimes you may need a little help just to be sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. So now we've identified this patient, which we said is pretty easy. You're probably doing this within seconds of them getting in here. Now, what's the management?
Well, you know, what I was taught back back in the day, the traditional management has, for many of us, were used the mnemonic LMNOP for Lasix, morphine, nitrates, oxygen, and position. That's what's on the stone tablets when I was training. And there are many people that are still using that. But the problem is this traditional management was really all predicated on the fact that these people were total body fluid overloaded. And I mean, even now, when you look at literature or guidelines, what have you, this is an instance where up to date is really not so much, because they even state in their overview of decompensated CHF that the cornerstone of management is Lasix for diuresis and its vasodilatory effect. And again, no.
Yeah, I think that's such a common issue, and I think we're going to talk about it a whole lot here in a second, but. Yeah, Lasix is not the fix-all. And, well, I mean, you've done all the talking here. Why don't you explain that? Why is Lasix not such a good idea for these patients?
Sure. Well, again, you know, these folks are fluid overloaded in their lungs. And, I mean, Lasix doesn't work on the lungs. It works on the kidneys. Because when you look at what's happening with these folks, they are clamped down. Their afterload is sky high. Their brain, their heart, their lungs are getting perfused, but the kidneys are not. So they're not even seeing whatever Lasix you give. And, you know, we've all had the experience back in our naive days. We'd give these people Lasix and then we'd run over and watch the Foley bag and nothing would happen. So then we give them more. Nothing would still happen. And then finally, when you do the appropriate treatment, the kidneys finally do see the Lasix. These folks will absolutely dump their pressure. They'll bump their creatinine. And you'll see it, for example, if you're managing these folks in the ICU. One day you're giving them Lasix, the next day you're giving them fluids. I mean, it just goes on and on. So it's really not the treatment of choice here. And the whole kind of myth about the vasodilatory effect, that really is not a thing. It was based on some pretty weak evidence. I think it was in the anesthesia literature where they were injecting it directly into arm veins. And that isn't really all that good evidence in my mind. And there is some more recent data now that's showing some potentially adverse hemodynamic effects, at least initially using Lasix.
Well, damn, you've already shot down Lasix. What else can we shoot down of this mnemonic?
Sure, we'll shoot down M for morphine. The thought was that it was a good anxiolytic and help with people coming in with air hunger, and again, thought to have some vasodilatory effect. But again, no. Respiratory depression is really not something you want to add into the mix with these folks. And if you look at the recent studies around using morphine in acute coronary syndrome, they actually show higher mortality in these patients. Plus, if you're looking at the antiplatelet inhibitors, it actually impairs the effect of these. This is not really something you want to use in a patient that might need to go to cath lab. And then there was the analysis back in 2005. It's called the ADHERE analysis, with ADHERE standing for Acute Decompensated Heart Failure National Registry, which in my mind is a bit of a stretch for an acronym, but we'll let that go. But actually showed people, patients that were given morphine in decompensated heart failure actually had increased mortality, a longer inpatient stay, and actually increased ICU admits when it was used. So don't use morphine.
Now we've shot down Lasix. Now we've shot down morphine. I mean, then what am I supposed to do to treat these patients? I have no idea anymore.
Right. There's no hope. But again, when you're looking at how to treat these patients, you have to target three different things. You're looking at the preload, you're looking at the afterload, and you're looking at LV dysfunction. So the good news is if you reduce the preload and reduce the afterload, the left ventricular dysfunction generally improves. So you don't want to just jump right on that initially, the dysfunction, I mean, because using ionotropes in these folks can lead to adverse cardiac issues, as they can cause increased afterload in people that are usually hypertensive. intrusive. So again, you want to decrease the afterload, not contribute to it. So inotropes don't really have a place in early management. The hypotensive patient, as noted before, is the scary rarity, and we'll discuss that treatment separately.
Oh, God. So now what do I do?
Well, non-invasive pressure support is really the thing that should happen first. I mean, basically when they come in the door, because it addresses so much of what's going on with them. I mean, it's decreasing their work of breathing, it's improving their air exchange, and most importantly, it decreases their preload and afterload due to the increased intrathoracic pressure. So if you've got the decreased preload, that causes decreased right ventricular output to an amount that the left ventricle can they can actually handle, which improves the backup in the lungs. And if you decrease the afterload, it also improves the left ventricular output as well. And since we started using this non-invasive support, the intubation rate in these crashing CHF folks has really decreased demonstrably.
Well, I mean, I had fun intubating these patients, though, because, I mean, they're hemodynamically stable, right? And they have no oxygenation issues, and they, I'm sure, have no, you know, acidosis issues or alkalotic issues. I mean, these patients were easy to intubate. I mean, why are we getting rid of that? We could just go back to that again and not worry about this non-invasive pressure. I mean, you just said a lot of words that didn't make any sense. So, to me, I mean... I guess whatever. We'll switch to the non-invasive management. Sadly, yeah. I'm saying all this as a joke, but I'm sure there are people out there who, and it's no fault to them, actually believe this is the way we should be managing these patients still, is that, oh, we drop the tube in, we give them the fluid bolus of 30 cc's per kg because they're septic anyway, you know, but their lactate's high, so it has to be sepsis. It can't be anything else. So this is the scary part about this management, is that this is so easy to screw up. And these patients are delicate. When they're this sick, they are delicate. And you can easily screw them up with just throwing the wrong type of medicine at them.
Right. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. So actually, I mean, we talked about non-invasive positive pressure ventilation as being a key cornerstone, and that's huge for this. It really has changed the amount we need to tube these people, and it's made life a lot safer. Now, sometimes you may still have to tube them, especially if they're decompensating to the point they're not really breathing anymore and doing the job of what you need. But a lot of these patients, you catch it early, especially when you start doing the pharmacologic side, you can make a huge difference for them. And I guess now, since we said that, we need to talk about some of the medicine that we use.
Absolutely, absolutely. So the top three drugs of choice in this case are nitro, nitro, and nitro. If you give nitro, it gives a rapid decrease in both the preload and the afterload. And we're talking high-dose nitro here. It causes marked venodilation, which decreases the afterload and the preload, so there's more pooling peripherally, reducing those ventricular volumes. And that relieves a lot in the myocardial stress and the oxygen demand. But the major issue with the nitro is you can't be half-assed about it. So basically with nitro, you want to use early, use often, and just go high initially. I mean, and any route you can get it in is fine. If you want to use sublingual initially, if you don't have a line, go for it. I mean, give them the sublingual while you're getting the line ready. And I mean, everybody has their own style with this. You read about it. Some folks will give sequential boluses in the first several minutes. Others will bolus, then drip. Some simply will use a high dose drip. But the major thing here is you can't be afraid of the high doses. I mean, the doses we use in acute coronary syndrome are essentially homeopathic. You can't go that low. I mean, you might as well not be using it at all at a low dose. So being aggressive is key, at least initially in the first few minutes. And if you look at what's effective, I mean, they're generally 100, 200 mics a minute initially, which is, you know, vastly different from what we use in ACS. And the good thing with nitro is its half-life, it's so short that even if someone drops their pressure, you can shut off the drip and have it resolve without any other intervention. So you just turn that drip up.
And this is an issue that sometimes you're going to get some pushback from nursing. They're not used to this. This is totally okay. And sometimes it takes a little bit of education. So kind of what do you do about this?
Well, you know, it's okay. They're doing their jobs. And, you know, so when the dust clears and things are settling down, it's reasonable to explain that when they're giving sublingual nitro, they're giving 400 mics at a time. So if they're repeating that several times, they're giving already the equivalent of 80 mics a minute of the drip. So having them get comfortable with the higher doses shouldn't be too much of a stretch. I was reading some people's blogs and that type of thing, how they deal with that type of thing. And some of them will ask the nurses to turn their back and they'll turn the pump up or whatever. But the good news is you generally don't have to have it up very high for very long. It's just, the first couple of minutes you really whack them and, you'll already start seeing effect within the first few minutes. And then you can sort of gradually get it down, but you just have to be aggressive up front.
And if you're a budding or already a resuscitationist or emergentologist, however you like to call yourself, this is something that I think you need to own up. If the nurses are backing away, shying away because this isn't the standard or they're not used to this kind of situation, that's fine. But you as the clinician, you as the one at the bedside who's going to actively try and save this patient's life and lead the treatments to get that way, if it gets to the point where you need to actually operate that pump yourself because you're the only one in the room who's willing to do it, need to own up and actually go ahead and do this. Because again, this is someone who's acutely sick. You've got minutes to get this person corrected. This is not something to waste your time on. And I really love, Michelle, the fact that you mentioned the sublingual. And I really didn't think about it this way until you put in the way we're talking about it, was that 400 micrograms essentially in that sublingual dose and how you dose it, you're essentially doing the exact same thing. So now that doesn't mean to use sublingual nitro instead. They need to be on a drip, but this is a good intuitive way to explain why and how you're doing this. And so I really, really like that point.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And again, that's a good plug for, while you're trying to get a line in this person, just give them a sublingual. That's getting a jump on it, may be beneficial. So.
Exactly. So now we've hit the key point on nitro. Aren't there some other medications we could essentially use?
Oh, absolutely. There was pretty good evidence from back in the 90s that using an ACE inhibitor acutely, either sublingual captopril or IV enalaprilat, which I've never used either one. But they really are great afterload and preload reducers with increased perfusion to the kidneys, which actually leads to some diuresis without using diuretics. But generally, though, I've found and I've read that if you're aggressive enough with the nitro, you generally don't need to go down that route.
Yeah, and actually, I haven't used that in that sense myself. But then again, I haven't seen a whole lot of these cases. But what I really want to know, Michelle, because the hospitalist is bugging me about this, what about the Lasix?
Right. Well, the bottom line is everything else first, period. It's not going to help you in the initial management, and it may actually be detrimental. So what I tend to do after they're turned around, I'll give a small dose before calling the hospitalist because they're going to ask me, how much Lasix did you give? And I mean, it's inevitable. It's like death and taxes. So I'll just give a bigger dose if I truly feel that volume was an issue. But otherwise, I'll just give them like 10 or 20, just in case it was an issue. But I don't hit them with it hard. I just hit him with it so I can say I did it.
Is this like the labetalol for, the blood pressure that, oh, it's just too high. Okay, well, I'll just give you a tiny little bit, just enough to keep everyone shut up long enough because it's really not the main issue we're here. But they say I have to treat the blood pressure before I go upstairs, even though they've been like this forever.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. So I think it's finally time we need to talk about this. What about those scary, scary hypotensive patients? What do we do with them?
Well, I typically make a blanket fort and hide, which again, just delays the inevitable. But, these are the folks that are even sicker. They're the ones where it's generally a primary pump issue and it's not the preload or afterload issue. So they're the ones that really will need either ionotropy or dysrhythmia management, depending on what the underlying issue is. But they're generally the ones who need an ionotrope. And you want to consider first line probably dobutamine. And then if you need a pressor, if the blood pressure doesn't respond to the dobutamine, then that's very reasonable. But again, these are the folks with a primary pump issue. And really all you're doing is temporizing so the primary problem can be addressed, whether it's ischemia, whether it's an arrhythmia, what you need to treat the underlying thing with these people.
And this is actually a very unique and important point to pay attention to, because this is one of those times when actually norepinephrine, which I love norepinephrine, that's my go-to drug, norepi. That's the thing for most cases. But really in this case, because of what you're trying to treat, dobutamine, this is one of those times that dobutamine steps up. And do not confuse it with dopamine, please.
Yeah, there's no role for dopamine in pretty much anything, I think, at this point.
Oh, but everyone loves to use it still for some reason. I'm not sure why. I get to see that quite a bit. And that's one of the common questions I ask is, why are we using dopamine versus norepinephrine or whatever else we're going to use? Because for some reason, some people really like it. But there's a lot of myths and there's a lot of problems with dopamine. Sepsis has actually had a lot of good research on why to use norepi versus dopamine. But I think I'm getting a little off on a tangent here. Just the main thing to remember is in this type of patient, dobutamine, almost said dopamine. Good God.
Slap your wrist.
I know. Dobutamine is what you need to do.
Absolutely.
All right. So that was actually a really great review. And I think we need to kind of summarize our points because there's a lot that I just learned.
Excellent. So, I mean, basically, these acutely decompensated people show up and they present looking awful, but it's one of the more gratifying things that we can see in emergency medicine because you really can turn them around and turn them around quickly. But when they come in, there's generally three things that are awry. They're too much preload and or too much afterload, and it's them impaired left ventricular dysfunction. And you have to stay away from the traditional idea that this is usually a fluid overloaded situation, but it is usually not a fluid overloaded situation. The fluid is distributed where it shouldn't be, namely the lungs, but the whole body is typically either hypovolemic or euvolemic. So that's why traditional, quote unquote, management isn't so good. LACES is ineffective and can be deleterious in these folks, and morphine can lead to bad outcomes, so just don't use it. And the true cornerstones when you're looking at the management are decreasing the preload, decreasing the afterload, and improving left ventricular function. Non-invasive positive pressure ventilation does help with all of this. Nitrates help with all of this. And as far as nitrates go, go high or go home with your dosing, because low dose won't get you anywhere. ACE inhibitors are reasonable add-ons, but generally not necessary. And if it's a primarily a pump issue, which is generally the case in the hypotensive CHF patient, support the heart and take a look to get to the root cause.
All right. And that was so much info. So great. Michelle, you've been awesome. I know there are others out me who are just amazed and basking in all this information. And really, I mean, there's a lot of great resources out there. And I want you to listen to those too. We'll give you the resources such as that Skate podcast from Scott Weingart. But I would encourage listening through this again. This is a nice, quick way of getting the information. We'll include in the show notes some of the key research articles and papers that relate to all of this. But in the end, this is something that you need to know well. This is not something that you push off to the side and you're going to wait until you get that kind of patient. And then you're going to go to FOMED and figure out how you're supposed to do this. You know, type the question on Twitter and wait for 20 responses. No, this is something that you need to know from the beginning. This is not something you want to delay care for just because you're not exactly sure. This is one of those true emergencies where the first few minutes can make all the difference for this patient.
Absolutely.
So, Michelle, again, thank you so much for coming on today and giving us all this wealth of knowledge. I am looking forward to having you again on here sometime soon. We need to figure out a topic for that. But I guess until next time, can you go ahead and give us the tagline?
Well, sure. Until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.